Welcome back, everyone, to Lecture 3 of this Mises Academy course, The American Prison State. I'm Professor Dan D'Amico of Loyola University New Orleans. This week, according to the syllabus, what I wanted to discuss was the contemporary economic perspectives on crime and punishment. Last week, we focused predominantly on sociological perspectives. In particular, I'm sort of subtitling this lecture, The Counter-Revolution of Criminological Science. Please pardon the spelling error on this opening slide. For those of you familiar with the Austrian tradition, you should recognize this title in so far as F.A. Hayek titled a significant book on, I guess what you would call it, is history of thought. Or the science and economics of the history of thought, called The Counter-Revolution of Science. The subtitle of Hayek's book, The Counter-Revolution of Science, is The Abuse of Studies in the Abuse of Reason. And this refers to Hayek's broader political economy project. What he was calling the abuse of reason was the notion that institutions similar to the pricing mechanism in society serve an epistemic role. They communicate the tastes and preferences of society from sort of the hearts and minds of individual people into a meaningful and digestible framework that can inform and update people's individual actions. So the price mechanism articulates a form of knowledge that no one can centrally plan or design, and Hayek sort of goes on to recognize that other forms of institutions in society serve similar epistemic roles, as does the price system, law, legislation, and liberty. He discusses the role of common legal systems as serving this similar coordinative role in providing a way in which society can harmonize itself. Now, for anyone who's familiar with the Institute for Humane Studies, they subscribe to a model of social change articulated by F.A. Hayek in the short essay, The Intellectuals and Socialism. Hayek, in that essay, lays out this sort of relationship wherein he's echoing this argument introduced to him by Mises that ideas matter in society. If we're going to understand the course of social history, then we should understand the course of ideas, particularly ideas in the social sciences, as motivating those changes in sort of real social space. So Hayek explains that there are sort of first-hand dealers in ideas, intellectuals, academics, thinkers, and people who create and generate and argue for new ideas. And then there are sort of second-hand dealers, people who communicate and disseminate those ideas. And then there are sort of like third-level consumers of ideas, the general public. And that this process of disseminating ideas then motivates processes of social change. I would argue that this concept of social change often gets misunderstood in the exponential growth of the say, liberty movement today, in particular with regard to how young people should best allocate their time to promoting social change by means of, say, libertarianism or Austrian economics. So there's this tension between, say, policy activism on the one hand and intellectual discourse and more formal academic pursuits on the latter. I think, in other words, a lot of people think that motivating ideological change in society is a matter of popularity. And so you hear a lot of, well, we've got the ideas, so let's just go and communicate and market them. What we lack is sort of a clean-cut presentation of classical liberalism, and that's why it's sort of not well-recognized and not more influential in matters of public policy. I think that what that confusion represents is an ignorance of Hayek's more complex theory of social change, which is articulated in The Counter-Revolution of Science. Now, in The Counter-Revolution of Science, Hayek argues that it is less a matter of popularity of an idea that influences social change, and more, the accuracy of the idea. So in other words, Hayek's arguing that there is such a thing as positive social science. There is such a thing as, say, what Austrians would call a priori law of economics. And it's with reference to that reality that matters. When we have a divergence in the ideas and opinions of people walking around in society and influencing public policy, that they are ignorant as to the real cause and effect relationships of social science. That's when we get bad policy. That's when we get bad social outcomes. When we have instead people walking around who accurately understand things like spontaneous order, things like the importance of property rights, things like the role of markets in society, that's when you're going to get a public policy that appreciates and protects those things. So what Hayek's really talking about, I suppose, is that there are tendencies in social sciences, sort of an inherent bias in the way in which the social sciences have approached certain social questions and social problems that is almost, it's like the deck is stacked against us. In other words, understanding complex social phenomena by its very nature is more difficult than is understanding, say, physiological processes. If you want to understand the laws of physics, just like drop stuff off of cliffs and measure it and look at it and watch it bounce or break or reflect in different areas. Achieving variance of abilities as well as a wide variance of motivations, the science isn't as clean cut. In other words, Hayek's often plagued by, well, why is it that similar agents would perform behaviors differently, and why is it that different agents would perform some behaviors similarly? Any sort of model or explanation of human behavior would have to account for those sort of anomalous patterns. And he lays out all of these sort of difficulties in differences between social science and positive science in the Counter-Revolution. Now, so again, the subtitle, the Abuse of Reason Project, what he's talking about is the course of the 20th century, the course of sort of social science history, wherein we often abandon the rationality and the reasoned functionality of emergent or spontaneous order institutions like the price mechanism in exchange for central planning. And while central planning is motivated by this claim of, oh, well, we're going to achieve efficiency and rational allocation of resources, it actually accomplishes the opposite because it can't replicate the same forms of knowledge as the sort of organic spontaneous order process. Now, my argument in this lecture is pretty straightforward. It's that the pattern of tendencies that Hayek explains to be occurring in economics and social sciences more generally, wherein social scientists tend to oscillate between positivism or the fallacies of positivism and the fallacies of scientism, and we sort of inevitably drift from an appreciation of spontaneous orders because of the cognitive challenges associated with social science. In other words, it's cheap and easy to understand physical sciences. It's hard and complicated to understand complex things. So we opt for treating social sciences like physical sciences. And this is sort of a failure. McCloskey, Deirdre McCloskey's current work is arguably motivated in resolving and reacting to the similar challenge that Hayek is talking about. McCloskey's whole concern is that when you purge the essence of humanity from social sciences, you're essentially purging the subject matter itself. We are often concerned with, say, falsely anthropomorphizing physical processes or physiological processes. Early explanations of things like weather and lightning were often explained with reference to the will of gods and so forth. Zeus is angry, and that's why it's lightning outside. That's bad science. It's not even close to science. So the physical sciences were very much concerned with having things like purpose and intention, choice in their explanations. And so they purge one convenient method of avoiding those sorts of problems is positivism or measurement, quantifying factors in your observation. And then the problem with that is, how do you know you're measuring the right thing? And so one of the solutions on that is sort of the scientific method, promoting generally researched hypotheses, challenging them against others, defining terms and testable methods, and engaging in intellectual discourse therein. Now, again, this sort of makes sense in a physical science setting, but it seems that the social sciences were similarly concerned about false anthropomorphized explanations for certain behaviors, and we were concerned about a lacking or the techniques and methods of those physical sciences become attractive, right? We end up sort of wanting to participate in quantifying endeavors and scientific exercises in much a similar way. My argument in the course of this paper is merely that on the applied topic of crime and punishment, criminology, if you will, that these same patterns of oscillating positivism and scientism play out and can be traced in these topics as well. So another way to think of, Hayek uses the metaphor of a pendulum swinging between positivism and scientism. So in order to assure yourself from the fallacies of the former, you sort of drift into the latter and vice versa, and you often are overcompensating. You're becoming too positivistic for the sake of your discipline, or too scientistic for the sake of your discipline, in large part because you're reacting to the errors that were previously made by chasing after the previous goal. Instead of a pure pendulum swing between these two perspectives, I really like this framework, which is from a paper by Pete Betke, Chris Coyne, and Peter Leeson, called Man as Machine, The Plight of 20th Century Economics. And so basically, if you're looking at this graph, there's two axes, formal language versus natural language is your vertical axis, and particular topic versus universal topics is your horizontal. So in other words, what they are arguing is that the beginning of economic science, say the classical school, Adam Smith, they predominantly used natural language. I mean, An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations is a big, thick book with lots of words in it. But they also considered themselves like worldly philosophers. They didn't necessarily think of themselves as engineers of society, and they didn't necessarily think of themselves as public policy analysts. They did explain economic processes with regard to what they saw outside in the world as it was going on, but in general they were just sort of asking questions about the essence of economic behavior, about the essence of human action, and a broader appreciation of Smith's research project. When you look at all of the works that Smith wrote, you recognize this more explicitly. It's comparable to Hayek. His topic matter changes. He has a book on like astronomy, and he has another book on theory of moral sentiments, which is basically just sort of asking questions and investigating the processes that social norms go through. And so Betke and Coyne argue that the original sort of debates between the German historicists and the classical school are mostly arguments over the role of theory, whether or not you can have universal theory in economics. German historicists are more like sort of case study scholars. They're interested in looking at individual environments and saying, well, that doesn't necessarily mean that you can extrapolate from these individual circumstances to anything more meaningful than what you observe in those individual circumstances. So they're inherently more empirical than are, say, the Austrians and the original political economists in the classical school. But once we get into the 20th century, we start to drift from natural language into formal language, modeling, behaviors. So by the time you get to, say, the Chicago School and the Neoclassical Project, you're up in the top right quadrant, wherein you have people like Samuelson, Arrow, Hondabrew, et cetera. And so in addition to that type of formal modeling, and there's a lot of ways that you can track that trend. If you look at, say, popular textbooks in the first half of the 20th century, you notice that things, the proportion of text to mathematical symbols sort of, first of all, mathematical symbols get introduced into those textbooks at the beginning of the 20th century, then they sort of grow and dominate the footnotes, and then eventually the sort of language gets put in the footnotes and the math gets put in the main text, and then eventually sort of the world that we live in now, whereas the natural language is purged entirely. The course of the 20th century has been this also drifting towards the left of the upper left quadrant, while we had a narrowing of focus, let's say, and in the narrowing of focus, we retained some of the natural language usage. So this is like sort of the 1950s and 60s and 70s with the rise of the Chicago School and the UCLA tradition. We get a greater appreciation with people like Friedman and Alchin about how it is that there is a basic logic of economic science. There's still the notion of particular circumstances. So economic science as a discipline gets more focused on things like interest rates and yield curves and financial markets, and we lose sight of these broader investigations of what we would call the praxeological project, understanding human behavior on its own terms. Like, these economists look very different from people like Adam Smith, who had books on all facets of human decision-making and human behavior. Or they certainly don't look like Smith. They don't look like Hayek, who's writing books on everything from neuroscience to legal systems. Now, today, we have something like formalistic historicism and game theory, right? We're not concerned about universal principles at all anymore. We're not engaged in sort of big think topics. We're more engaged in like individual case studies, individual models, and whether or not they apply in individual circumstances. So Becky Coyne and Leeson are arguing also that this is a unique opportunity for people like Austrians, because we never sort of stopped thinking in universals. And the big think questions are more welcome and appreciated in these sort of mainstream discussions, especially in light of current financial crises and development economics, because we have this inherent realm of environments where the traditional models don't seem to apply. So they're arguing that this multiplicity of methods, everything from game theory to experimental economics, new institutional economics, these are all sort of arbitrage opportunities for people like Austrians to come in and say, hey, I can sort of look at your empirical findings and look at the variance of your case studies as well as the models that you apply, and sort of arrange them in a way that comports to broader, more generally applicable theories that we've been working on all along. So again, I think that this sort of arrangement, in conjunction with Hayek's counter-revolution of science, pendulum swing or a delicate tightrope between the fallacies of scientism on the one hand and the fallacies of positivism on the other hand, and the tendencies for both of those traditions to fall victim to social engineering and the sort of unsavory aspects of central planning and coercion, growing government, can definitely be found in the social science, especially the economic social science, dedicated to the topics of crime and punishment, or criminology, if you will. So the rest of the lecture, what I really want to do is survey these different schools of thought within the history of criminology. So first and foremost, we have what's called the classical school of crime and punishment. And interestingly enough, it's arguably sort of the first school. We didn't really have a whole lot of attention in any sort of social theory or social philosophy or social science. Not much attention was paid to crime and punishment as an independent discipline until the the late 17, early 1800s. So it's a relatively modern phenomenon. In large part, I would argue, but like don't necessarily have a proof for at this stage of this lecture, that this is in conjunction with the rise of formal governance, in large part because of the rise of a distinction between the criminal and the civil law. During earlier periods, for example, we don't have a formally defined and articulated criminal law because most of the functions that we attribute to the criminal law today are serviced instead during those earlier periods of time by the civil law. So by the time we get to the 1800s and the 1900s in England and the developed world of the time, is when we're first starting to see the rise of a state-defined and state-delineated criminal law. And so the major sort of social thinkers at the time start to ask questions about, well, we're concerned with the problems of the world and we're concerned with the problems of society, and so those topics have a demand market for books, for analysis. And so if you claim to call yourself a social thinker at those times, you sort of have to be touching base on those. Now, it's not a coincidence that the first school of criminology shares sort of a identifiable name with the first school of economics, or the first sort of commonly recognized school, which is to say that most of the classical school economists had particular comments and or applications to crime and punishment, but all of the classical criminologists. So if you were to pick up today a history of criminology, the first people that you're going to cover are people like Beccaria, Bonassana, Jeremy Bentham, even scholars like Adam Smith and John Stuart Mill. The classical figures in our history of economics. All of the classical school criminologists also recognized and identified themselves as political economists. So I think that there, what we can see and recognize in this early period is something that has gotten very lost and unrecognized in contemporary references to this tradition. In other words, if you look at Hayek's Individualism and Economic Order, the first chapter is called Individualism, True and False, and Hayek articulates a distinction that he argues that Jeremy Bentham, for example, is different from, say, Alexis de Tocqueville. And so he's concerned that Benthamite, formal rationalistic individualism, always tends to lead to socialism, whereas more evolutionary and perhaps ignorant forms of individualism, imperfect individual learners as opposed to individual optimizers, is a more preferable model. So that sort of distancing that Hayek presents compared to Bentham, I think is important. Lots of people who are trying to sort of argue against the free market tradition, especially its application to crime and punishment, want to lump all of the sort of like economists in the same camp, often failing to differentiate scholars who appreciate, I think, the subtle subjectivist implications of knowledge, as I think Beccaria is referring to here in this paragraph. Our knowledge is in proportion to the number of our ideas. The more complex these are, the greater is the variety of positions in which they may be considered. Every man hath his own particular point of view, and at different times sees the same objects in very different lights. Now, remember, Hayek is totally concerned about that sort of variance. The spirit of the laws will then be the result of the good or bad logic of the judge, and this will depend upon his good or bad digestion, on the violence of his passions, on the rank or condition of the accused, or on the connections with the judge. So now that the first part of this quotation you could read out of like a public choice or Austrian book about subjectivism today, not necessarily on the applied topic of crime and punishment, but Beccaria's book that this is taken out of is particularly focused on, it's on crimes and punishment, that's like the title of it. And it's a very short book, but this passage in particular, I think, highlights that they have a recognition of knowledge and the imperfect distribution of knowledge that most economists today who talk about crime and punishment didn't have yet. And so it's a very different sort of approach than, say, Bentham has when he's writing things like the Panopticon and the Rationale of Crime and Punishment. But here, again, you can recognize these guys are concerned with universal theories of crime and punishment, right? There's a model of criminal behavior, which is driven by rational choice, in their head, and that's trying and aiming at informing their policy suggestions for shaping society to respond to it. And so Bentham is pointing out the basic sheer rational calculus. Bentham has everything that Gary Becker has in 1968, but he has it in like 1740, in the late 1700s. In other words, he recognizes both that increasing the severity of punishment is one avenue for deterrence, and secondly, increasing the probability of capture is the other. And third, he recognizes that proportionality, mainly getting right the optimal pattern of prices of punishments, matters because what you can do is accidentally encourage certain types of criminal behavior. Alton and Allen effects. I mean, Bentham's actually ahead of his time on a variety of margins. So what we're looking at here is basically the Alton theorem applied to, or the third law of demand, applied to crime and punishment. The same nominal punishment is not for different individuals the same real punishment. Let the punishment in question be a fine, the sum that would not be felt by a rich man would be ruin to a poor one, the same ignominious punishment that would fix an indelible stigma upon a man of a certain rank would not affect a man of a lower rank. And what Bentham ends up saying in the Rationale of Punishment, where this is taken from, is that if there's a greater benefit associated with committing more severe crimes, say killing as opposed to beating, but no different penalty, then you're in effect incentivizing more severe crime. We've seen this in more contemporary instances when we have things like three strikes or outlaws. On your third offense, you're going to jail for life regardless of what you do. So the optimal strategy from a criminal's perspective is often to do things like killing witnesses. If you're going into a store to rob the cash register, it's a different incentive with a three strikes regime compared to without. With the three strikes regime, your incentive is to sort of shoot the clerk. So again, I think that Bentham sort of stands alone in his more hyper-rationalistic approach compared to, say, Beccaria, but also Smith. Smith and Mill, people forget, had a proto-Austrian content, especially on this topic of crime and punishment, because not necessarily in writings particularly dedicated to these topics, but Smith and Mill were amongst the first vocal critics of torture practices. And the argument that they make isn't that it's necessarily immoral or inhumane, but that you cannot trust the information that torture provides, that that there's no reason to recognize the accuracy. Their insights parallel extremely work that's being done right now by Roger Koppel, who compares sort of the knowledge that's generated by democratic processes of election and selection across particular platforms compared to sort of market choice-driven sets. And then he uses that to inform and criticize the institutional structures designated for forensic science, how we know who committed crimes, things like DNA testing and the standards and procedural protocol for arresting criminals. So these guys are a huge splash as far as the rise of social science is concerned. Smith is sort of like super popular in his day, but as are Bentham and Beccaria, they have major appointments. They're like personal tutors for fancy political types. They write books that sell well. And as the 1800s progress and we get closer into the 19th century and soon the 20th, what arises is what's called the positivist school. Now, ironically enough, I mean, these guys are open and admitting that they call themselves positivists. So the concern becomes that if you're going to have a science of crime, then you have to have measurement. Now, I think that this is sort of a perfect example of the way, like, scholars today, like McCloskey, criticizes, say, economic science. If we're so obsessed with positivism, so obsessed with quantifying what arguably is unquantifiable in the social sciences, we risk purging the purpose-driven, the meaningful aspects of human decision-making. We're actually purging the object of inquiry. If we're trying to understand human beings, but we treat them like billiard balls, then we're not really saying much of anything about human beings. And so I think that when Hayek says that these tendencies in social science tend to lead to things like social engineering with some very distasteful results, the positivist school of criminology is a perfect example of that problem. This guy, Cesare Lombroso, is basically one of the pioneers of eugenics and social engineering. Nazis pointed to his work explicitly throughout the German fascist experiment. Listen to the sort of language. He's talking about criminal behavior as though they are sort of mutated biological specimens. The distinction between the criminaloid, the occasional criminal, the criminal by passion, and the born criminal, as well as the study of the more important causes of crime, enables us to determine with precision, right? So he's seeking a predictive measure in order to hone public policy resolutions, the individuals to whom we can apply our curative processes and the method appropriate to each case. So they're explicitly looking to resolve the problems of crime at the social level. And the technique that he goes about doing his studies, it's really interesting. In the 19th century, there's this this proverbial joke about modern macroeconomics. Many people would say that modern macroeconomics is a proverbial joke, but this is a joke that captures the irony that is modern macro, which is that you're walking down the street and there's a guy, it's nighttime, and there's a guy sort of bent over looking at the ground under a lamppost. And you approach him and you say, oh, did you drop something? He says, yes, I dropped my wallet. And you say, oh, you dropped it right here? And he says, no, I dropped it way over there. And then you say, well, why would you look here? And he goes, well, way over there, there's no light. So I'm looking where the light is good. That's sort of what has plagued macroeconomics in a nutshell. We've been constrained about our applications and our topics by means of where we have good or bad data. So when Lombroso is writing at the later part of the 19th century and the earlier part of the 20th century, it's basically some of the, once Bentham's insights get adopted, he drafts the Panopticon, which is basically an architectural design for how to construct and design penitentiaries. That gets adopted throughout the developed world. England and the United States are the first sort of front runners, and everyone, especially France, for example, send de Tocqueville and Gustave de Beaumont to inquire and look at these systems. And I think that that represents a fundamental misunderstanding in social order. It's basically the opposite of the classical liberal perspective. They're presuming that, well, the United States is an exception. Their rate of growth is very good at this time. The rest of the world is sort of mired in political upheaval, war, economic turmoil. But here we have the United States, which is basically new. It's a nation of immigrants who are not particularly hyper-intelligent, per se. They're farmers, and yet their levels of social order really high, their levels of crime really low, their levels of economic progress and capital accumulation are outpacing other nations. So every major sort of political leader is fascinated by this like new American exceptionalism, and I think that they're presuming that, well, it must be the planners. It must be a better system of law enforcement and designed social order that is motivating these exceptional results. Because if they were on equal footing with everyone else, then they should be experiencing sort of the similar social patterns that are happening in the developed world in other parts of the world. I think that de Tocqueville in particular gets the nail on the head, which is he writes a report on the penitentiary system and its application in France, but it's very sort of flat, it's very positive, so to speak. He's just saying, okay, this is what different townships have different particular legal processes and particular criminal legal sanctions. A lot of them have these sort of prison facilities, but they're pretty rare inside. Some of them are really dirty and gross, and they definitely don't seem to be driving any significant role of social order per se. In fact, what he's saying is that these prisons are extremely humane compared to a variety of like scaffolding processes and stuff that have been experienced in the past. And where they work, they work insofar as they don't get relied upon very often. What I want to argue is that the subsequent publication by de Tocqueville, Democracy in America, is a response to his entire sponsored trip to the States, which was to investigate the penitentiary system as an explanation for America's exceptionalism. He's saying, look, you idiots, you got the whole thing wrong. It's the civil society and the informal processes that are taking place in the free world of the West that are actually driving its exceptional characteristics. The reason why people are doing well is because they're constantly allowed the opportunity to learn how to do well. All I'm really trying to emphasize with regard to the positivist school is that during this period of time when Lombrosa is writing, he's victim of this sort of empirical bias, in large part because this is the same time frame where all these new prisons are being built. So if you're a social scientist who's obsessed with measurement, and you have all like these new sort of housing units for holding people, it's one of the first areas of social science that we get the positivist tradition, because if you want to study people, it's a complete data set. It's a closed data set. You have a group of people that you can ask them any number of questions. They sort of have to answer you. They're not going anywhere. You can track them for long periods of time. But one of the first things he starts to do, rather than sort of trust and rely upon the information of criminals and bad people, he just takes any sort of proxy measures that he can get. And so the original proxy measures of criminals are facial features, head size and shape and misshape of head to everything from the size of your nose and the shape of your forehead to the diameter of your skull and the proportion of your ears. He tracks like all of these sort of genetic biophysical characteristics of criminal inmates. And he notices, well, you know, criminals are really ugly relative to the general population. They often have scars. They have very like asymmetric facial features. Now, in hindsight, a lot of this was caused by the criminal justice processes used at the time. If you ended up in jail, it's often after you had been sort of beaten by police officers or whipped and lashed as preliminary forms of punishment, or had just lived a life of vagrancy and wandering, which involved those sort of processes. Lombroso assumes or concludes that these biophysical features are genetic. So criminality becomes an inherent or a heritable trait, that there are families of criminals, and that if you really want to save society from the effects of crime, you would have to affect the reproduction of these criminal classes by means of anything from euthanasia to, what's the word? See, if you guys were here, you could remind me of this. Sterilization techniques. So this guy is not cool. His student, Alexander Lacassagne, the debate between these two basically sets up the whole like nature versus nurture debate in criminal justice science. Lacassagne, also obsessed with measurement, so he's still a part of this positivist tradition. He wants to measure different stuff. He doesn't want to measure the biophysical. He wants to measure more social indicators. So instead of noticing, well, criminals are ugly relative to the free population, what he notices is that criminals are oftentimes orphaned. Going off on sort of an initial round of preliminary inquiry with inmate populations, he notices that lots of them are systematically reporting that, that they had been orphaned, that they had no parents, that they, grew up on their own and on the streets, and that, they're much more a function or a product of society than they are a product of criminal families. So, this quote, sort of sets up the social determinism that gets popular with everything from Marx to Foucault in later sociological perspectives. Social environment is the breeding ground of criminality. The germ is the criminal, an element which has no importance until the day where it finds the broth which makes it ferment. Justice shrivels up, prison corrupts, and society has the criminals it deserves. So, this is the early part of the 20th century, but within a few decades after this, we get Foucault, who situates himself as an extension of Marx and Durkheim. Durkheim is arguing that if you really want to understand society, you have to look at prisons and you have to look at the criminal classes, because it's basically like the poo. I gave a lecture recently at IHS where I reminded students of the scene in Jurassic Park where they're trying to understand why the dinosaur is sick, so they're like, oh, well, we've got to look at the droppings. And it's like this big, giant pile of Tyrannosaurus Rex droppings. But Durkheim is basically saying the same thing, that if you look at the sort of problem pools, the cesspools of society, you can reverse engineer the processes that contribute to those things and comprehend what exactly is going on in the social world. So that gets picked up in the early to mid part of the 20th century, and Foucault is really the first person to shine a light on prison social history and asking questions like, okay, well, where do these institutions come from and what effect do they have on human decision making? And that launches this whole sort of like super focus on the social driving forces of criminal behavior, which are weaker and sort of varied versions of this basic point that Lacassagne is talking about. So by the time we get to the 1960s and 1970s, the practices of rehabilitation have radically changed. The prison project, like Bentham's Panopticon and its adoption throughout the developed world, is a rehabilitation paradigm of criminal justice. Despite the fact that some of the particular practices don't look very rehabilitative in modern terms, in other words, before we had, say, incarceration, we had things like flogging and whipping and scaffolding and so on and so forth. But unlike guillotine practices before them, these practices were designed and implemented with the belief that they would have a rehabilitative effect, that you would learn the costs and penalties of crime, and you would be compelled to be a better person, so that when you were reinserted into society, we were taking bad out, replacing it with good, and then ideally you would have some sort of like feedback process where society improved over time. By the time we get to the 50s, 60s, and 70s, these sentiments that society is really producing these actions or contributing to criminal behavior is what's motivating a shift from, say, flogging and torturous practices towards something more ideally humane, like incarceration, isolating individuals, sort of constraining them from the processes of physical violence. And so rehabilitation practices in particular that go on within prison facilities by the time we get to the mid part of the 20th century look more like everything from electroshock therapy to psychotherapies, sort of like Freudian explanatory processes, etc. Now, the the latter part of the 20th century brings the rise of the Chicago School. So lots of things are happening simultaneously that contribute to a massive paradigm shift in especially American criminal justice systems. We're now sort of like the dominant international power, and so our practices really have influence and shape the trends throughout the world. So Becker writes his article in 1968, but lots of economists are talking about this. Last summer I was at George Mason, and Gordon Tullock, for example, has a number of unpublished manuscripts, and he has a paper explicitly titled the same thing as Becker's, The Economics of Crime and Punishment, and it's dated in 1969, and so Becker just eats into the publication and he shelves the project. But treating the concept of criminal justice and crime and punishment through the lens of economics is a popular trend. It's sort of they're re-universalizing the subject matter of economics. But other things are in place in outside the economics profession that really set the stage to allow Becker's model to really take hold. So again, we have this dominant perspective that society is what's contributing to criminal behavior more so than, say, rational choice. So it changes the legitimacy of punishment practices. We drift from torture to incarceration to psychotherapy. Now, well, in 1970, this guy Martinson does a survey piece where he basically gets all of the empirical findings of rehabilitation processes. So he says, okay, well, here's how many inmates are applied this rehabilitation scheme, and here's how many inmates are applied this rehabilitation scheme, all the various forms of psychotherapy. And then he compares it to recidivism rates. So he looks at sort of the funding that goes into the rehabilitation process, the varied strategies of the rehabilitation process, and then looks at the real outcomes, recidivism. When you are released from jail, how often or likely is it that you commit another crime and get reintegrated into the prison environment? And what he notices is that as not only is nothing seemingly actually lowering the recidivism rate, but the recidivism rate is going up, as are the funding and the various strategies of rehabilitation. So Martinson, interestingly enough, was trying to contextualize his work as a criticism of incarceration. He was trying to say, look, you know, this practice is aimed at rehab and it's not working. The way it gets perceived in the public press is that all this money on these sort of inmate rights programs and whatnot are for waste. At the same time, Becker's writing an article that says, look, we can understand criminal behavior in terms of a rational choice theoretic. So crime is on the rise, 1960s, 1970s, people are really frustrated with how plagued by criminal behavior their urban environments are. The movie Death Wish is out, that was Rothbard's favorite flick. But actually, I mean, that movie gets cited in a number of philosophical investigations on crime and punishment. H.L.A. Hart, who's the leading standard on the retributivist model, cites Death Wish as basically the conditions of ordinary American citizens. So lots of contributing factors lead to, again, a new paradigm shift where we abandon the sort of rehabilitation project and instead bring up retribution, that it's not for rehabilitative aims that we legitimize the practices of punishment and the practices of incarceration, but it's instead the notion that criminals deserve to be punished. One of the logical sort of setups is if we were to imagine something like Hitler being trapped on a desert island after the Holocaust, and he learned to like the desert island, he was sort of making pina coladas or something, then it would be a travesty of justice because Hitler was so evil that there's a karmic imbalance in the world that he would need to be punished in response. Martinson, the guy who actually does the sort of massive criticism against the Nothing Works, titled The Nothing Works Perspective, is so distraught by his work being used to promote the retributive process and the re-justification of incarceration and the sort of harms it does on criminal inmates, ends up throwing himself out of a window. which is sort of a tragic biographical story about him. So again, Becker's just basically reintroducing the Benthamite perspective that there is a rationality to criminal behavior and that we would expect to see deterrence achieved by increased punitive severity and or increased probability of being arrested. Now, the more contemporary empirical investigations have noticed that the latter, the increased probability, is far more effective and arguably less expensive than, say, increased punitive severity. It's also, you just get more bang for your buck. In other words, if the criminal agent is thinking about robbing a store and the punishment associated with robbing a store jumps from 5 years to 10 years, that deters less than if the probability of being captured jumps from 20% to 40% at a given punishment rate. Which makes sense, especially when you get into high rates of annual prison sentences. So following Becker, you get scholars like Isaac Ehrlich, who is basically, positivist insofar as he's concerned with measuring the quantifiable effect of punitive severity. But what is difficult at this time is that, again, the data is not so good. So rather than, say, noticing the deterrent effects of marginal increases and decreases in punitive severity by means of prison sentences, he's looking more at the comparisons between states with and without capital punishment. And so while Ehrlich, I think, or many people would say Ehrlich is sort of the empirical justification for the entire Becker model, I think he's actually just talking about a very, very narrow application of the Becker model, which is capital punishment specifically. So sure enough, his findings report that there is such a thing as a deterrent effect from capital punishment. States with capital punishment don't necessarily have have fewer violent crimes, especially murders and first-degree murders, than do states without. Even if those who violate certain laws differ systematically in various respects from those laws who abide by the same laws, the former, like the latter, do respond to incentives. So it's just the economics of the Chicago School, I think, is right. The question is, in application, whether it's complete and or capable of fully comprehending the various subjective implications perceiving the cost of punishment on the part of criminals, as well as perceiving the benefits of crime by criminals. So where we're at now is sort of, again, we do the similar lap as Betke, Coyne, and Leeson's diagram alludes. We're at a narrowing of focus matter with regard to crime, but we've retained the sort of formalist techniques. So the new economics of crime, Stephen Levitt, for example, represents this tradition. Rather than, say, looking at a broad rationale of criminal behavior or a broad understanding of crime and punishment, he's more concerned with, okay, why did crime fall, particularly within a set period of time, the 1990s, and constraining to empirical techniques, what does the data imply are statistically significant versus non-significant influences? And his results are sort of interesting insofar as they connect this apparently nebulous behavior of the Roe v. Wade decision as retaining a statistical significance even when he tries to sort of get rid of it. Like who would think that something as strangely unrelated as legalized abortion would lead to significant declines in the crime rate? His logic is that unwanted children do have a significantly higher rate of criminality than children from two-parent households, and so sort of eliminating that class before they're born does, in fact, again, it's sort of comparable to the creepiness that is the Bonasana insight from earlier. John Lott, I would argue, is also in this camp. So the more guns, less crime insight. But again, he's interested in these very current issues of the decline in crime in the 1990s and the particular regions of deterred violence that he observes. Another good book, which I don't have a slide for, is this guy Mark Kleiman, when brute force fails. In other words, I want to argue that this new economics of crime does have the same sort of opportunities as does the game theory, formalistic but isolated case opportunities that Becky Leeson and Coyne argue. I want to say, like, these guys allude to similar opportunities for Austrians and public choice style insights. In other words, when we say that something is ancillary as Roe v. Wade, or something as private and dispersed as gun ownership, Kleiman also argues, similar to Gladwell, he's got this sort of tipping point argument that these small issues associated with, like, cleaning up graffiti on subway cars and changing light bulbs and washing floors and promoting cleaner environments in New York in the 1990s had a significant effect on lowering crime rate. I mean, when you're in a subway with lots of graffiti and the lights burnt out and there's sort of dirt and grime everywhere, criminals perceive that it's opportune environment where they will get away with committing crime, whereas if things are well maintained and clean and so on and so forth, even though it's like they have the same physiological opportunity to sort of mug and rape old ladies, they don't perceive that they can sort of get away with it as easily. Again, so like collected all of these insights, I think, allude to the fact that criminal justice planning is very, very difficult. In other words, thinking in terms of Becker's model, right, that if we increase punitive severity, right, the length of a prison sentence, well, that's really expensive compared to, like, taking out the garbage in a subway station or allowing people to own their own guns. Or, like, it's impossible to legislate today what might be the next sort of ancillary effect as impacting as Roe v. Wade. So we should contextualize things like dollars and cents spent on criminal justice in these formalized models with reference to these sort of dispersed and emergent effects of private behaviors as an opportunity cost, that every dollar spent in the formal processes of criminal justice is by definition a dollar that can't be spent on private gun ownership. Or Bruce Benson also traces significant correlation. He takes the census data that's available since the 1970s and notices that the industry is dedicated to private security, everything from hiring a private security guard to private security systems in your household and those sorts of industries have grown exponentially in lockstep with the decline in violent crime. So again, I think that what these things are collectively alluding to is that the public policy response to criminal justice is more varied and complex than I think our democratic process, informed by hyper-formalized models, is capable of well matching. So again, I think it sort of fits the same sort of argumentative structure as Hayek's counter-revolution of science point. We're about at the hour mark, so if anyone has questions that they would like to type into the chat box, I'm going to scroll back and see if anyone asked anything in particular. Every few minutes the sound is dropping out. Anyone else having this problem, or is it just my connection? I think it was just your connection, at least I hope. The Constitution of Liberty, Hayek calls the rationalist approach the French tradition and the evolutionary approach the British tradition. Oddly, Bentham ends up being French and total British here. That's a great observation. I don't know who wrote it. Matt? No. Mises Institute. Was that Danny? Cool. Yeah, absolutely. I'm sort of like in conflict with Rothbard on this issue. Rothbard is a big proponent of, say, the French liberal tradition, as am I, but he argues that, like, sort of Smith ignores them. And I don't necessarily think that's true. I think there's a lot of appreciation to the French liberal tradition that can be seen in Smith. I think Hayek and Smith are both scholars who you really benefit when you read sort of lots of their work. If you engage too closely and narrowly in one particular text, you lose sight and understanding of the broader research programs that they're trying to pursue. which I think are both parallel in sort of the classical liberal perspective more generally, which is just the relationship between micro and macro, if you will, or the relation in Austrian terms, the relationship between individual behavior and spontaneous order. How institutions affect individual behavior by promoting incentive and knowledge arrangements that induce particular forms of individual behavior, but then also the way in which those individual behaviors contribute to the development of those institutions that bear that influence back upon themselves. Lucas Grisham said, also doesn't make criminals out of those having giving abortions. Not sure I understand. I assume it was in reference to the Levitt. Doesn't make criminals out of those having abortions. Oh, right. But I mean, statistically, you can. So I, to summarize or articulate what Lucas is saying, it sounds like, well, obviously crime is going to go down when you legalize a behavior. I assume and can verify that Levitt is controlling for that, right? So I mean, when we say crime is going to go down when we legalize drugs, well, obviously all of those people who are doing drugs are no longer criminal. But in particular, violent crime is going to go down. And that's an argument about the sort of substitution effects of criminal behavior. When you when you're enmeshed in prohibition, if you're a meth dealer, you're willing to sort of shoot someone because it's lower cost relative to losing the profit opportunities to trading in meth. So even though, yes, you're no longer a criminal because you shoot, because you sell meth, you're also probably no longer a violent criminal because meth is legal. I think that's the point, or those sorts of effects are what Levitt gets to tease out with the empirical work that he does. More questions? Pretty please, we still have more time. Another really great book that just came out, but I'm not as enamored with it as other people, and I'm not sure it delivers exactly what it promises, but it's sort of fun and sexy nonetheless, is this In Praise of Flogging book by this guy Peter Moskos. Peter Moskos was a sociology PhD at Harvard, and then he graduated and joined the police force in Baltimore. He ends up being like an advisor on The Wire, which is a Showtime show. It's really good. His first book was called Cop in the Hood, and he does a lot of really interesting observational work about how technology innovations get implemented in the police department, and they, because crime response is such a complex social phenomenon, these sort of exogenous changes, like you get a spending shock, so more money gets funneled in through the federal level for local police jurisdictions. So they adopt these new technologies without sort of really knowing how their broader police processes are going to work. So things like transistor radios radically change the nature of policing from a cop on the street who works a beat and walks up and down and has to introduce himself as a member of the community and actively deters crime. Once they get transistor radios and have centralized dispatch and response to crime, in essence, police jurisdictions are letting crime happen and then responding to it. So crime rates actually go up even though they have sort of more sophisticated technologies. Peter Moskos' new book is boldly titled and pretty radical in its implications. It's called In Praise of Flogging, and it's arguing to give criminals a choice between going to prison or being flogged. And he has a great survey of sort of prison history more generally. My dissatisfaction with the book is that it's not radical enough. He wants to replace the technique of criminal punishment without addressing the monopolization of law enforcement. So in other words, flogging was what we had before we had prisons, and it naturally sort of led to prisons, as I sort of explained or alluded to in the course of this lecture. So he doesn't necessarily have a stopping point for why that would be avoided in his system. It requires a lot of sort of political slash constructivist policy changes. But what he's doing is just using that as a window. He's basically saying, I'm gonna advocate something totally ridiculous in order to shine a light on the real costs of incarceration. And on that, he does a really good job. Lucas asks, doesn't deregulating the market for rights protection solve the profit prison problem associated with partial deregulation? If people paid premiums for rights coverage protection, then the premiums would reflect the risks associated with different levels of recidivism, and there would no longer be the for-profit problem with companies having a vested interest in perpetuating criminals. The companies would have an interest in recouping their money that was paid out as a result of the violation, which means they would have an incentive to rehabilitate vocational training, the inmates. It would be competitive rehabilitation systems where the offenders would stay until they could repay the company necessary to procure the rights coverage necessary to interact with society again. I like these sorts of exercises that you read about in things like Rothbard and the Tannehills. And I think that, there's no reason to deny that incentives would motivate and accomplish things like rehabilitation in a private market setting better than traditional systems. I don't necessarily think that, I mean, I'm more, again, Tocquevillian on this. I think that what a system in a free society would look like is sort of unknowable. Because what you would need to have is lots of different social environments innovating and experimenting with lots of different enforcement strategies. I don't think it's very likely that you or I can design or implement an effective system of criminal justice akin to what a market would produce. However, I do think that that there's a significant difference between the way in which private companies are incentivized to be constrained in their use of force against ordinary individuals, whether they be criminals or victims or innocent bystanders, and that's a very different incentive system that's faced by people like government, for example. In other words, a lot of the material that's come out on this stuff from the sociological perspective, in particular, a book by Bernard Harcourt on the illusion of free markets, as well as sort of the implied comparisons made by scholars like Naomi Klein. They want to say that the market process, by means of profit, is inherently coercive. So Naomi Klein, she thinks that, it feels like we're free and and filled with liberty when we're sipping our lattes at Starbucks, because we're allowed to sit on the computer and pick our nose and sip our drinks for hours on end and read a book, and nobody's telling us to leave. But really, they just want to sell you something, and I think that's right. But she's then concerned that we're exposing ourselves excessively to the interests of private companies, and in consequence, we are ignoring the maintenance and provision of our democratic social space. So it's while you and I are sitting in Starbucks just finding it so chic and wonderful, the music and the paintings on the wall, we're sort of neglecting our public libraries, and we're neglecting our public schools, and we're neglecting all of these sort of more democratic governmental public spaces. And I think what she's missing out on is the role of force in these different environments. So she's saying, look, you couldn't hold a labor union meeting against Starbucks in a Starbucks. Probably right. But when you did and you were asked to leave, it would probably be pretty civil, which is to say that the relationship in legal terms between Starbucks and those individuals is civil. They have equal sort of protections against the law. So, Starbucks could hire or call a private a security guard, and they would escort those people. But Starbucks has every incentive to not use excessive force, to not be associated with a massive sort of violent interaction on their own space. Well, compare that. So people do these sorts of protests at private companies all the time. Sometimes there's pickets. Sometimes they're more sort of explicitly voluntaristic, right? So flash mob dancing is a big one. Well, compare, I recommend this, Google flash mob Target, and then compare it to flash mob Thomas Jefferson Memorial. when you're unwanted on state and public space, the way in which you're dealt with is very, very different when you're unwanted on private space. And I think that the school system is a great example. I mean, going into public education facilities today is arguably more invasive than even getting on planes at the TSA. And so I think that she has a very romantic vision of democratic space and a very sort of like excessive pessimism about private space. Question from Harris Kenny. Does Leavitt effectively put a respectable mask on Lombroso's beliefs? Has he received criticisms for his findings from anyone besides social conservatives? Not many people have had the boldness to call Leavitt a eugenicist on this. I don't think they should. I mean, he's just sort of data mining. He's not willing to advocate for more abortions per se. I think the real conclusion is that crime is a complex social phenomenon. And I think he's using a lot of his work to demonstrate more the costs of the drug war. So I don't think he has these sort of intentions associated with it. He reports that finding in large part because it's sort of like sexy and bizarre. It made a big media splash when he did it. Also, I mean, it's strange because it's not criticized by the left in large part because they advocate for a variety of forms of sterilization at the global level with similar sort of consequentialist effects. Al Gore has an entire chapter in Earth and the Balance about how sterilization and subsidized contraception should be a strategy for alleviating poverty at the global level. We should be sending those things to Africa in order to maintain the proportion of breeding between what the wealthy, educated classes compared to the impoverished poorer classes. I think it's unsavory. I'm sure lots of libertarian types do. But you don't get the sort of outrage and discussion of those things as much as you do today. I also recommend David Levy and Sandra Pierce's book, Vanity of the Philosophers. Basically, they argue that eugenics movement in the 1800s is an ideal sort of case study of exposing the consequences of central planning. In other words, that if you hope to, even on their own terms, the eugenicists, they face knowledge and incentive problems in much the same way as all sort of government programs do. Have any of these academic theories trickled down to more popular theories of crime and criminality? If so, where do you see these hybrid theories? I guess I would ask a follow-up question, Laura, like what you mean by popular theories of crime and criminality. I do think that these academic theories reflect the sentiments or popular trends of their times. In other words, discussions about nature versus nurture and discussions about the responsibility of the criminal and popularity of retribution morals do sort of reflect both popular sentiment and academic popularity in conjunction. So in other words, there is like an ideological thrust of society at any given time. Experts espouse on TV and popular literature. Well, okay. So this is what we also have very bad data on scientifically approaching that question. In other words, what a lot of people have started to look at is, such as in the last lecture on the sociological theories of crime, is that you have a lot of people looking at public opinion data. And so the problem with that, though, is that we only have public opinion data from places where it's easy to get public opinion data on. So we have first world Western countries report an approval for retribution, right? If you go around and you ask people what should happen when someone commits a rape or what should happen when someone commits a certain crime, they often come up with very like torturous and or severe consequences relative to what we actually do. And if you ask them what we actually do, they predict that it's significantly less than what it is that we actually do. Which is to say that they suffer a form of rational irrationality, if you understand Brian Kaplan's work. Or another way of saying that is that there's no pricing mechanism for communicating a preference for severe punishment. Lauren Lomasky is another guy whose theory of expressive voting sort of dovetails Brian Kaplan's rational irrationalities theory nicely. Kaplan is arguing that the reason why people remain relatively ignorant and systematically biased on these topics is because they don't face any sort of individuated costs and benefit structure. We benefit from the public provision of justice, but we don't have to privately pay a cost for it, so we overconsume. Well, Lomasky's saying, even if we don't benefit objectively, right, we like increased punitive severity doesn't necessarily have a real deterrent, a systematically deterrent effect on crime relative to other areas that don't spend that money and other times that don't spend that money. He's arguing that so long as we believe it does, we're going to get those sort of voting processes. In other words, if your only mechanism of achieving justice is this button of the criminal justice system via the prison process, then when you are wronged, you naturally think that that button should be pushed. Because, which I think it fundamentally ignores the fact that what having that button and what insisting upon that button does is crowds out other, perhaps more effective buttons. And I think if you just have conversations with people, that's sort of reflective in the world that we live in. Even libertarians say regularly, like, well, if you break the law, you should go to jail. But I think it's sort of a sad giving up on the creative challenge of actually finding institutional forms that best serve the needs of society. From Mises' institutional offer, Rothbard is also critical of Smith's espousal of the British evolutionary tradition of Hutchinson and Smith, spontaneous order, results of human action but not of human design. Do you also agree with that critique? I'm not directly familiar with Smith. Oh, so Smith is espousing the British evolutionary tradition. I like evolutionary theory. Insofar as Rothbard is critical of spontaneous order, I'm a much bigger advocate / fan. I think that, so what I'm arguing is that Hayek espouses spontaneous order tradition. There is a significant degree of spontaneous order content in Smith, and I think that Rothbard is too critical because there's a critical role for the spontaneous order tradition in the Austrian project. In other words, it's the spontaneous order understanding of institutions, especially, say, the pricing system and even the criminal justice system, that we use as a basis of comparison for understanding the processes that occur in our more governmentalized system. And it's odd that Rothbard like doesn't necessarily recognize this. I think it's predominantly because of his insistence and appreciation for natural law theory as opposed to his more economic orientation. So, like, what has government done to our money, I think, is awesome as a piece that I like to point to in people using Menger's Origin of Money as a comparative analysis tool to develop a criticism of public policies that we actually have today. Whereas I think that Rothbard's punishment chapter in Ethics of Liberty is very out of place. And historically, that's just true. I mean, that book is a very systematic exercise in sort of a Aquinian and Aristotelian essentialism. And he pauses that meticulous methodology in the punishment chapter. And a large part of that is because that punishment chapter wasn't written to be a part of that book. The punishment chapter was instead written to be a part of a collected series included in Randy Barnett's Assessing the Criminal. And Randy Barnett commissioned from Rothbard explicitly a piece on retribution, because Barnett was already taking up the case for restitution in his own chapter and had someone else sort of working on the rehabilitation chapter. So it's odd when scholars like my colleague Walter Block and Stephen Kinsella have really taken up the sort of retributivist task of Rothbard in advocating for heightened punitive severity as like a starting point for the bargaining process in natural legal systems or natural law legal systems. I don't think it's a consistent application of the Rothbardian framework that he lays out in Chapter 1 of Ethics of Liberty, where he talks about natural law being that which people are inclined and naturally enticed to do. I think if you were going to be consistent, you would have to have a much more restitution-based norm, which actually converges on low levels of criminal sentencing. If you look at restitution experiences and practice, it's not two teeth per tooth plus a scare or anything close to that. It's usually a fraction of the original damage. Credit card companies settle for cents on the dollar. Forgiveness practices and compliance, behavioral compliance for future issues is much more often the types of sentencing that lead to resolves conflict in actual anarchist experiences. Are there any statistics comparing the number of violent crimes committed on public property versus private property? I'm not sure if they count for that, but the majority of crime in general is on public streets. Break-ins are less frequent than, say, muggings. And that's just sort of function of the private incentives. I would look at the Bureau of Justice statistics and see what else you could find. I mean, basically, you want to just ask where crime takes place. It's not that they would actually keep stats on that, per se. Just wondering if we were to get an agorist society started by Samuel Abercrombie III, thinker I've been talking about a lot in the last 2 weeks, with the use of insurance companies with the profit motive, lower the amount of criminals because insurance companies would go through any amount of pain to apprehend criminals so as to keep customers. An anarchic society without government state control could be justified in reducing incarceration and criminal behavior. So Konkin is concerned, what you're saying is that Konkin is concerned that that the profit motive tied to crime leads to an incentive for more crime. I don't think that's necessarily true. I think profit motives are tied to consumer satisfaction. Competition that would motivate profits being tied to the relevant margin of alleviating crime rather than enhancing it. I mean, that's like saying that car companies have an incentive for their cars to break so that they can then replace the parts. But that's a prisoner's dilemma. You would need a significant amount of collusion amongst the auto manufacturers in order to actually get that to be a profitable strategy. So if Konkin's arguing that, I think he's wrong. He's wrong on a lot of stuff. Konkin was a weird dude. One's the politicians and other experts. It seems that there is a disconnect between academic arguments of criminality and what the rest argue as a causal connection. Oh, yeah. I mean, the majority of people about the majority of social sciences are misinformed, ignorant, and systematically biased. But that transcends crime and punishment, per se. Although one can't know exactly how it would work in a freer market, it seems the main problem in the current market is a lack of freedom in the right to exclude. Now, with the state having a monopoly on removing, re-releasing criminals from society property owners are not able to determine for themselves the cost of associating with various criminals. I suppose that's true. I think that finding innovative ways. So, for example, New Hampshire's Free State Project, right? They're trying to develop a way in which, like, to start a Facebook sort of thing just for their community because they're worried about some people moving there who might claim to sort of share these ideals of non-aggression and so on and so forth, but would do it with, like, an intention to exploit the kindnesses of others. And so they're trying to find ways to sort of out them as social deviants or whatever. So, I mean, things like social shunning is actually becoming more popular in the criminal justice literature, a lot of people, Ostrom's work, for example, like you get a lot of bang for your buck with just being rude to people who are bad people. So I, to the extent that the state sort of criminalizes or regulates whether or not you're allowed to refuse service to people and stuff like that, because of a fear of like racist inequalities, I think they're probably doing harm. Another one example of this is jury nullification. The history of jury nullification is motivated in large part by this concern. The one Supreme Court case is when it was like an obviously white racist guy kills a black guy, and then the jury lets him off through jury nullification. And so the Supreme Court was like, well, this is a very bad aspect of the jury process. But the jury process was put in place in order to be a constraint on the powers of the state. So yeah, one in every like several hundred cases does the jury reflect the sort of unsavory racist tendencies of the population. But far more disconcerting is the fact that the state sends dozens, hundreds, thousands of people to jail for things that the majority of people don't think it should be sent to jail for. Now, in an aftermath where the powers of jury nullification have been eroded significantly. So I think Hayek's point is that, well, we should have rule by like robust principles rather than throwing those principles out for exceptional cases. Like when in doubt, stick with the rule. All right, lots of questions are coming. So it seems that there's a disconnect. Okay, sorry, I'm in high level. Although one can't know exactly how it would work in a freer market, it seems the main problem in the current market is a lack of room. Okay, that's what I just answered. In one of the essays in Economic Controversies, Rothbard says that since there is no such being as society, criminal law should be completely replaced by tort law. Do you agree? Is that what you mean by this general restitution-based framework? Rothbard argues this, yes. John Hasnas is a legal scholar at Georgetown. He also argues this. I don't necessarily think it should be replaced by tort law. We have tort law. And historically, that's what the criminal law was trying to codify. So, yeah, I think that what the criminal law is, and again, so this essay in Economic Controversies is at odds with his description of the criminal process in his proportionality chapter of Ethics of Liberty. And in large part, I think that's because of the publication history behind those pieces. But so, yes, I think that tort law is a much better means of resolving dispute between individual people than is criminal law. Criminal law, in essence, is state. If you look at the rise of criminal law in the ancient world, the rise of criminal law in the more like contemporary Anglo-Saxon world, both come about in conjunction with the rise of state power. You don't have a criminal law when you don't have a state, and you don't have a state without the criminal law. And the process by which the state develops is one in which it monopolizes the adjudication of criminal disputes. So I think that one sort of quick, easy like catchphrase would be like, okay, there should be no criminal law. That we should allow civil processes where people are treated as equal civil agents between one another to resolve disputes as opposed to having a criminal law. I think O.J. Simpson case is sort of an interesting one to look at in this. If O.J. had been found guilty in the criminal law, then the Goldmans never would have gotten their sort of their civil restitution because he would have been sitting in jail. Now, they didn't get it anyway because he spent so much money trying to defend himself in the criminal case. So by eliminating the criminal law, you would reverse those priorities. In other words, what the criminal law really is in contemporary societies, it's a realm of behaviors delineated by the punishment apparatus of the state, that criminal law is that which is incarcerable. And so one way of resolving the prison problem is to resolve the criminal legal problem. Could there be a competitive identification company? There can be a competitive company in everything. Konkin did state that insurance companies, anarchy without government police, would help reduce and deal with crime effectively, or is that what you answered? I was trying to. In other words, stores could refuse service unless you carried the I'm not a molester, rapist, thief card along with your ID. I suppose it's true. I mean, not only that, but more like if you are a rapist, molester, or thief, that people would figure out who you are. Again, like the private sector is being pretty innovative on this, more so than is government. There's all sorts of computer, Web 2.0, sex offender registries, and other such things. There's also now like a MySpace of police accountability in certain areas, which are things that I think are good insofar as I think that people are very innovative and well-equipped at avoiding criminal violation. I lock my door. I know that I can buy a gun or a security device or buy a dog or any number of things that would have a significant deterrent effect on being victimized by crime. But what I can't do is buy something that will help me from being victimized by a police officer. And I think there's parallel insights throughout the development literature that's a much more debilitating effect on systematically economic development for a society at large, but it's also sort of much more contributing to uncertainty and all the behavioral debilitations that come along with uncertainty. Questions seem to have stopped, and we are also out of time. So thanks, everyone, for attending. I know we have 50 registrants, but only about 15 to 20 actually show up every week. That's fine. I know that the lectures will be posted for posterity's sake, and so all of you guys can refer back. The PowerPoints should be up, and the quizzes should be up in a day or two. It's up to Danny and the rest of the wonderful Mises Institute staff. So again, thanks for attending, and have a good night.
Thank you, Dr. D'Amico. Feel free to stop the recorder.
Okay, I'm doing that right now.